Ground Cover News is a nonprofit street paper that was founded in April 2010 as a means to empower low-income persons to make the transitions from homeless to housed and from jobless to employed. Vendors purchase each copy of the Ground Cover News regular edition at our office for 50 cents. This money goes towards production costs. Vendors work selling the paper on the street for $2, keeping all income and tips from each sale. This audio production was made possible by the Ann Arbor District Library, recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios. If you consistently enjoy Ground Cover Speaks, continuing to buy physical newspapers from Ground Cover vendors ensures that we can sustain production. The physical paper and in-person interaction is at the heart of our work. You can find the link to our next audio recording in the upcoming print issue of Ground Cover News. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to our print advertisers, the People's Food Co-op, St. Francis of Assisi Parish, First Baptist Church, Bethlehem United Church of Christ, the Office of Community and Economic Development, Cineholic, Art on a Journey, Ann Arbor for Public Power, Four Directions, and the Ypsilanti Food Co-op.
Los derechos de la naturaleza de la vida y las privacidades de un ser humano, cuando es tratado por un agente de ICE con uniforme como Hugo Chávez. No entienden de sacrificios y leyes antifascistas y usan el KKK como los símbolos americanos y no pierden el tiempo en hacer leyes imperialistas yanquis. Barack Obama y derechos humanos con leyes castristas y deportaciones de ICE, padres y abuelos pretenden limpiar las cenizas de sus antepasados y orgullosamente dicen que no hay hielo, pero con letras de ICE viven en orgullo narcista-leninista, yanqui imperialista. Te amo, Agapito, el agente de ICE.
Stupor is a poem of mine a long time ago. My name is Pedro Campos. For a moment, I intend to maintain control. I plant my feet on the ground. Watchful eyes around me. Plan, project, progress. Reflect. It's important to review recent events. Suddenly, for a moment, if it is or not intentional, I don't know. I seek insanity at all costs. Giving up on agreements pre-established with myself and no one else. And I dive into wine and I get drunk. And when I'm at the stupor point, I hold on to it with all my strength. And I hold for hours, for days, for weeks, for seconds. Inside I create my world. Then everything passes soon. And it turns out that even before the hangover, the voice inside me starts screaming again. Ego, super ego. Yeah, I couldn't be alone, playful. In these questions, I find myself wondering whether or not I should have control. Because the sensations that invade my chest with the speed of a whirlwind, they come and go, they explode. This trend I've known for a long time because I always carry them with me. They don't respect my will, much less are predictable. I'm their puppets and I like it and I live. And I haven't even talked about love yet.
Dive into the Sheriff's Budget Reveals Predatory Revenue Streams by Marie, Ground Cover Contributor. This article focuses on an information session about a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, request filed by a Washtenaw County resident in March 2024. The documents in the FOIA request pertain to the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office 2024 fiscal year budget. Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office, WCSO. Research from the FOIA request was presented the evening of February 24th to a full farmers marketplace in Ypsilanti. The title of the event was A Deep Dive into the Sheriff's Budget, a Civic Education and Strategy Session. an RSVP through the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, ICPJ, to the event promised an informative summary of over 300 WCSO budget-related documents, brainstorming of community-based solutions to financial harms waged against incarcerated people, loved ones, and the community, and an exploration of current community-led initiatives like participatory budgeting committees driving the future of county spending. The event's presentation operated like keys to unlock several issues and open the door to talking about them. During a pre-info session phone conference on February 23rd, the event's presenters, Kat and Korn, along with this writer, clarified interest. Korn is a paid Michigan Justice Fund research fellow hired in fall 2024 by ICPJ to review FOIA documents pertaining to the fiscal year 2024 sheriff's budget. It should be noted this was the budget of Sheriff Clayton, not the newly elected Sheriff Dyer. Kat was brought on to the FOIA project as a research assistant and brings previous employment experience as a social worker in the county jail. This writer is a forensic peer originally trained locally under the umbrella of a human trafficking specialty court pilot grant. The session's contents should not be confused with research paid for with funds directly from the Washtenaw County Public Safety and Mental Health Preservation Millage, which can be found at washtenaw.org. Korn and Kat summed the information session up as a broad overview of what was found in the budget based on what was received, including clarification about some of the contracts. This article used information presented during the education strategy session with experiences from community members directly impacted by incarceration. Anonymized community members will be referred to as Buddy in this article. During the February 24th info session, the presenters described the documents received in the FOIA request as not comprehensive because they were missing known details, lack of clarity in available documents, and missing contracts. While the contents of this initial FOIA request includes memoranda of understanding, a line item budget, and other documents, some integral items are missing according to researchers. Among the documents provided, a profiteering pattern appears to have emerged. Profiteering is arguably evidenced by jails making money off of inmates, not promoting humane conditions, and conflicting law enforcement contractual obligations. WCSO has multiple funding sources, including the recently renewed millage, internal WCSO contracts, and state and federal grants. During the presentation, the jail was reported as WCSO's largest expense, notably with a jail funding shortage cited as impacting WCSO's ability to provide quality health care and food to prisoners. Holes identified while researching the FOIA documents, combined with issues around current jail operations, suggest there are possible ways to address waste, improve accounting accuracy at many levels, and intentionally improve community wellness. Revenue through service contracts. Among the more alarming examples of revenue identified during this FOIA research was commission-based or for-profit incarceration practices, especially around food and telecommunication supports. Two WCSO contractual examples of for-profit incarceration in the presentation were reported as Securus and Canteen Services. WCSO appears to be operating like thousands of other law enforcement agencies, as these contract holders have similar agreements with other carceral institutions. Securus Technologies LLC was presented during the info session as the only method available for inmates to communicate with supporters. Contact between an inmate and their support network, including family members and attorneys, is currently made available via commission-based online visitation and phone calls. While some professionals may find direct access to inmates, contacts during incarceration are expected to occur via commission's telecommunication methodology. The Securus portion of the info session included a table showing how WCSO profits through commissions of 20% when inmates communicate using Securus technology. The table showed the breakdown of additional fees that may change depending on the size of the purchase package or at any time with 30 days notice. For comparison, 50 text messages have a package price of $5, from which WCSO receives a 20% commission. However, the full price for a 50-message package after additional fees becomes $9.75. A package with 400 texts has a base price of $32, from which WCSO receives a 20% commission, yet the full price to purchasers after applicable fees becomes $42.15. Securus reportedly made several contract amendments during the pandemic, many of which increased costs. In addition to the financial strain of utilizing Securus features, one buddy described a stressful experience of trying to answer a call while driving because they recognized the significance of an incoming call originating from the jail. A second buddy pointed to issues with privacy as a reason for not utilizing jail telecommunication. The buddy's precautions proved justified as the info section about telecommunication concluded with an example of Securus violating privacy laws and charging extra fees for location-based services. Concerns with privacy and inappropriate costs were cited as prompting a WCSO contract change in 2020. When discussing jail technology, another buddy said, "It don't work like it does in prison, so it doesn't really matter." Food was a presentation focus on several sides. Therefore, the issue requires attention from multiple angles. The current food contract at the county jail, according to the researchers, is with Canteen Services, LLC. Cat and Corn described food as a tool for managing inmate behavior and reducing liability. Food costs were reportedly referenced by the previous sheriff as a significant factor in the jail's budget deficit. Presenters explained that the nature of the Canteen Services contract encourages a larger jail population by lowered per meal costs and commissionable earnings potential of up to 45%. According to the presentation of the 2024 fiscal year budget report stated, rising food expenses has surpassed personnel savings. While it may be true food costs are on the rise, there was a 2020 change reported in the contract. The current contract dictates the larger the jail population, the larger the price per meal, and the more inmates spend on commissary, the larger the WCSO commission revenues. According to the presentation, the lower number of inmates during the beginning of the pandemic was costly as meal costs were high and commissionable opportunities were fewer. A buddy with food allergies shared that a medical professional suggested ordering commissary to address diet gaps. The same buddy was held on a $50 bond, never received funds to purchase commissary, could not make any phone calls, and is tested on the diabetic spectrum since being released. Regardless of who holds the food contract, a contractual challenge for the jail appears to be balancing staffing costs. Balancing staffing costs is more complicated than canteen. However, the condition might be improved with a clearer understanding of all applicable WCSO contracts. A buddy summed the current status of jail technology as not working like it's supposed to. Revenues through criminalization. A significant funding source mentioned during the info session included state and federal contracts. A 2024 contract highlighted during the presentation was a Justice Assistance Grant. This GI grant was packaged as a state road safety grant, which incentivizes criminalization of driving tickets. The presenters explained many current practices tie local funding to increased ticketing. Aside from the additional cost burden to citizens, the problem with many incentivized contracts is that many prospective financial gains are consumed by operational costs, including vehicle maintenance, fuel, and employee wages. Grant contracts often expect a large amount of costly fund matching. Historical examples of cost sharing include absorbing bailiff salaries, expanded court hours, unpaid or underpaid peers, a lack of pay increases for employees, billing insurance companies, and out-of-pocket costs to former inmates for tethering and drug testing. For those interested in combing through the FOIA request, reviewing the PowerPoint from the info session, or further exploring participatory budgeting, you may contact Cat or Corn via ICPJ at info@icpj.org. Consider engaging the Public Safety Millage Advisory Committee, which provides oversight on the WCSO millage revenues, and offer your insights and suggestions. In addition to other ideas, the session suggested a call for increased community participation, abolishment of for-profit incarceration, detailed transparency from the new sheriff's administration, and asked that funds be dedicated to addressing generational trauma from state violence. In short, better conditions are possible for all.
The 99th annual observance of Black History and Culture by Will Shakespeare. The year 2025 marks the 99th year of observance and celebration of Black American history and culture. Next year, 2026, will be the centennial anniversary of Dr. Carter G. Woodson's vision of putting African American experience at the center, not the margins, of the great American story. Who is Carter G. Woodson? Woodson is a famous Black American historian. He was the second Black man to earn a PhD at Harvard University. The first Black person to earn such honors was W.E.B. Du Bois, author of the classic book titled The Souls of Black Folks. Du Bois was prophetic when he wrote in the 1890s that the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. The prophecy for the 21st century is anyone's guess. He, W.E.B. Du Bois, also introduced the psychological concept of double consciousness. While growing up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, at the age of 12, Du Bois experienced overt racism and prejudice, which made him ask, how does it feel to be seen as a problem? Like Du Bois, Woodson experienced racism and marginalization during his youth and adulthood. Before Woodson called for the establishment of Negro History Week in the month of February, he founded the Journal of Negro History. February's significance. Why observe and celebrate Black history and culture in the second half of the month of February? Woodson wanted to honor Abraham Lincoln's birthday, February 12th, and Frederick Douglass's birthday, February 14th. Our history books and documents teach us that Abraham Lincoln did more than any politician in America to bring the moral question of slavery to a national debate. Frederick Douglass's oratory and eloquence inspired abolitionists and moderate Republicans of the northern states during the 1860s and 1870s to help end slavery and undertake post-Civil War reconstruction efforts. Those moderate Republicans of the northern regions were called the Radical Republicans. The post-Civil War reconstruction efforts ended in 1876 after the presidential election that some historians considered controversial. The Union soldiers were withdrawn from the southern states. Consequently, the rights and privileges gained by former slaves and their families were put at risk. Oppressive and restrictive measures put in place by the Southern KKK magnified, leading to the separate but equal Supreme Court decision in Plessy versus Ferguson. That decision was overturned by the Brown versus Board of Education case of May 17, 1954, ushering in a second reconstruction in the 1960s. It was important to Dr. Wilson that each year's observance and celebration carry a banner, which he called a theme. Last year's theme was a celebration of Black art. The 2025 theme is a celebration of Black labor. In the 2024 election, there were politicians who implied that immigrants were crossing the border to take away Black jobs. At the Black Journalists Association meeting in Chicago, a journalist asked the candidate what he meant by that. The response was that he meant all kinds of Black jobs, but many people took it to mean low-paid jobs. Black labor is diverse. It includes presidents, teachers, nurses, lawmakers, governors, etc. Conclusion. Black history transitioned from a week of celebration and awareness to a month-long event. The National Archives noted that on February 10, 1976, President Gerald Ford issued a message recognizing Black History Month, becoming the first president to do so. The previous year, 1975, Ford signed a resolution recognizing Black Awareness Week, urging all Americans to recognize the important contributions made to our nation's life and culture by Black citizens. In 1975, Woodson's organization, known as the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, urged President Ford to sign a proclamation the next year, which will recognize a Black History Month. He did. Presidents of both parties have written messages to accompany their annual proclamations. President Ford's message was indeed heartfelt. The National Archives said that President Ford called upon the public to seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. Ford's presidential message of 1976 inspired the U.S. Congress of 1986 to pass the Public Law 99224, which has ever since recognized February as our national Black History Month. We recommend to our readers to Google or find images of the U.S. Post Office display of African Americans of historical significance in honor of Black Heritage Month. There are hundreds of them. Those images show the diversity of Black labor, Black occupation, and Black working life. Also, the Post Office has a listing of more than 1,000 African Americans from all walks of life that have made significant contributions to the greatness of America. Recently, many journalists and historians say the nation is at a crossroads in terms of valuing the achievements of minority groups, including the African American community. Uncertainty abounds. However, we live in a highly optimistic society. No matter what challenges we face, we are inclined toward keeping hope alive and clinging steadfastly to our dreams.
Is There Light at the End of the YDL Construction Tunnel, written by Mike Jones, Vendor 113. The Ypsilanti community has been missing the downtown library for a year and 9 months. During the summer of 2023, a round of severe storms overwhelmed the roof drains and soaked the ceilings, walls, leaving the historic building with severe water damage. The downtown library building was built in 1914 as a post office. The water from the storm got into the building's old structure, the ceilings, all four walls, and the floor. The library staff who worked that night of the storm swiftly moved material away from the flooding, losing fewer than 100 books and some furnishings, officials said. The branch hasn't been open to the public since the evening of July 1st, 2023. The library director, Lisa Honing, previously announced the branch would reopen in late 2023, but the construction only began to repair upgrades, made announcements for the reopening many times over 2024, but supply chain issues have continued to cause an indefinite delay. CAN, C-A-N, Art Handworks, the specialty metalworks artisan, did not follow through on promised completion dates, and so the library and the project manager began to charge them daily fines for delays the work in January of this year. Honing stated in an online update, he is holding our library and our community hostage with the inaction. We are constantly optimistic that this will move the work forward. Instead, they ended up needing to switch contractors, and as of March 6, are working on the plan B to finish the vestibule. Still, there is no formal announcement on the official reopening date. The future is unclear, said Hong. The need to address water damage prompted an interior upgrade that included three new study rooms, a laptop computer with a view of the streets, some new furnishings, and a completely redesigned youth area. The alterations are intended to offer more amenities to future patrons upon the reopening of the library. YDL librarian Aaron Smith said the front doors would be different. Instead of two doors on both sides of the entries, there will be one big door that makes it easier for handicap accessibility. The information desk will be in the same area, but we have all new bookshelves and the arrangements of the books will look different. The computer, sitting, and reading areas are all new. For those who visited the library before, one might remember on the very back wall where we had sci-fi and graphic novels, that whole area now has three new meeting rooms. So now we have three small meeting rooms that will accommodate 3 to 4 people, and the big meeting room upstairs and the big meeting room downstairs. Upstairs, where the new book section used to be, that room is now a tech lab study area. Overall, we have more space for people to do their thing. It's going to be a great to reopen, and I hope people appreciate it. We are also looking forward to hearing feedback on the new amenities and upgrades. Libraries offer more resources than just free books and media. They are warming and cooling centers, a place to access computers and Wi-Fi, bathrooms and water. libraries offer free activities, and people can go there without buying anything first. Denise Shearing, Underground Vendor 485, shared her thoughts about the closure. I really miss the downtown library because it was one of my places I went to relax and hang out and have a good time. Sometimes I would go there just for some peace and enjoy the local scenery.
City of Ann Arbor and AADL announced plans for the center of the city by the City of Ann Arbor. During the past several weeks, City of Ann Arbor staff, City Administrator Milton Dehoney Jr., and Ann Arbor District Library Director Eli Nyberger have been in discussions to develop a shared vision for the surface of the Library Lane parking structure, referred to as the Library Lane Parcel. These meetings resulted in a draft framework for the site. I appreciate AADL Director Nyberger for rolling up his sleeves to imagine a shared vision for this underutilized site, said Administrator Dehoney. This vision takes a site that has been the source of community frustration for years and transforms it into a downtown jewel that could address several community needs. To unlock the full potential of emerging opportunities, we must prioritize strong collaboration between public institutions as a standard practice for progress and development. In 2018, the Ann Arbor City Charter was amended by adding a new section, 1.4, to Chapter 1. The amendment came about as the result of Ann Arbor City Proposal A for the city-owned public land, bounded by 5th Avenue and William, Division, and Liberty Streets, to be retained in public ownership in perpetuity and developed as an urban center, park, and civic center commons to be known as the center of the city. Moving the city and AADL shared vision for the Library Lane parcel site forward will require several steps, including Ann Arbor voters voting to amend the charter provision in an upcoming election, as well as the AADL Board and Ann Arbor City Council supporting an agreement that would be drafted to contain the following elements, including: this project will not require any new taxes, the City of Ann Arbor would sell Liberty Lane parcel air rights to AADL for $1, AADL would build a new downtown branch location that would span the Library Lane parcel and the library's current site at 343 South 5th Avenue. Above the new library, the project would provide a mixture of housing types, including artist spaces, condos, affordable units, and market rate units. Provide multiple event spaces for use by the city and the public. Provide new outdoor public open space, improved programming to be managed by AADL. Provide small business development space at below market expense. AADL would issue a public request for proposals and partner with development teams to develop both parcels as a single project. AADL would conduct a community engagement process to solicit public input on the project. The housing portion of the project would be a new property on the City of Ann Arbor's tax rolls. The city would continue to own the parking garage until the debt is paid off in 2042. At that time, the AADL would purchase the structure from the city using an agreed-upon formula. We're so thrilled to have reached this point where there finally appears to be an answer for the future of the downtown library and the Library Lane parcel that realizes the civic vision for the community that has been developing for decades, said Nyberger. AADL is the organization best situated to develop this site into a beautiful, engaging, and inspiring new asset for the people of Ann Arbor, Nyberger added. The city has demonstrated its capacity and commitment to professionally operate shared public spaces, sometimes in challenging environments, in a way that provides outstanding value to the entire community. City staff recognize that some framework details could be modified once input is received from the AADL City of Ann Arbor governing bodies. City Council is expected to consider an initial resolution at its March 3rd meeting. The AADL will consider a resolution at its April 1st meeting. This is an incredible opportunity for Ann Arbor, said Mayor Taylor. The prospect of a state-of-the-art district library downtown, thousands of square feet of public open space, hundreds of units of new diverse housing, multiple event and gathering locations, all without raising taxes, is an absolute game changer. I am so excited to work with city staff, my colleagues on City Council, and the AADL, and the public to make this vision a reality. We invite readers to submit their thoughts about this project to the Ground Cover News editorial team at submissions, S-U-B-M-I-S-S-I-O-N-S, at groundcovernews.com, groundcovernews.com. Thank you.
People in the Neighborhood by Jim Clark, ground cover vendor number 139. This is Mona's story. I asked Mona how she would describe herself to people. She replied, "I'm a good person with a bad need for a place to stay of my own. I've been homeless for 4 years, all the way from Detroit to Ann Arbor." "Why are you homeless?" I asked. "Because most places want first and last month's rent and a security deposit, and they want you to make 2 times the rent and income. Some places want 3. "What are you doing to improve your situation?" I asked. Her answer was unexpected. "I struggle every day, sir. I cry every day, because I don't understand why I'm in this situation. I don't get it. I can't help what I don't make. I can't squeeze juice out of a dry lemon. It's hard, and I don't understand why they don't make it affordable for people on disability." Mona is receiving Supplemental Security Income, SSI, and a Social Security benefit adding up to $900 a month. It's rare to find an apartment in Ypsilanti for under $1,000 a month. She would have to save most of her government assistance money for the move-in cost of $2,750. Even if she saved $450 a month, it would take her 6 months. Then I asked, "Why are you getting SSI? Is it a medical disability?" She replied, "Well, I had some things going on as a kid. I really don't know what it's for, I just get it. I had it at an early age. The last time I remember talking about it to a worker was when I was 26. Mona will be 50 in August. She has been on SSI since she was a teenager. Then I asked, "What did you have going on as a kid?" She replied, "I had a baby in school." I then asked her what grade in high school she achieved before dropping out. Mona actually missed the last semester of 8th grade. She told me, "I was pregnant when I was 13. It was too young. I was just a baby. I had to quit school for a minute." We went back to talking about finding housing. I asked her, "So can you save the money?" She replied, "I have the money saved. The problem is they want my income to be double the rent. But even if it weren't for that, I can't afford the rent in most places." I asked her about other things that are known barriers to housing. "How is your financial credit?" She replied, "My score is 525. I had someone in my life that took advantage of me, and it ended up ruining my credit." I asked, "Do you have a criminal background?" She said, "I have 2 felonies. I asked, "Have you ever defaulted on a lease?" She said, "Once, in Detroit, 2018. That's 3 strikes in most places. Read that again. She has the money saved. The other barriers are why she continues to sleep on the streets. Then she exposed one more barrier. I asked her, "What about sharing a space or renting just a room in a house?" She replied, "I would like to have my own place. I'm tired of living with people and paying them and then having to deal with their attitudes. I'm tired of having to walk on eggshells around people who want to start fake arguments to get you to leave. And if you stay with a guy, you have to make it clear that you aren't going to be doing anything. It's like, I'm paying you rent. I'm not living here for free. So if you're looking for that, I'm not coming by. Just because I'm a woman doesn't give you, as a man, the right to ask for anything other than rent when it comes to me living there." People with privilege tend to miss situations where privilege matters. I asked a female friend for her perspective. She said, "If the only roommate a woman can find is a man, then she has to decide whether to trust him or continue to sleep on the streets. There can be an assumption of sexual favors, as Mona stated, and sometimes a risk of violence." According to a study by the National Sexual Violence Resource Center in 2003, among homeless and marginally housed people, 32% of women, 27% of men, and 38% of transgender persons reported experiencing physical and/or sexual violence in the previous year of 2002. In the bigger picture, it can be financial privilege that drives the increasing cost of housing. The real estate belongs to the privileged. and they can do what they choose with it, including leaving hundreds of thousands of human beings stranded in the winter. I asked Mona if she's ever slept in her car. She told me this story. A lady and her kids just died in Detroit in their car because it was cold. She had been asking for help since November. Nobody wants to help. Nobody cares. Homeless people's lives don't mean anything. But then when something like this happens, everybody wants to cry and say, oh, that's too bad, and oh, oh, oh. But when she was asking for help, nobody did anything. So what do they think was going to happen? Even a dog can find somewhere to go. Somebody will help an animal before they will help a human being. I imagine myself leaving that way too, so I can't sleep in a car again. I got frostbitten once. If it happens again, they will amputate my foot. So I can't get frostbitten anymore, ever again in life. There was a long pause. I then asked a few happy questions. If you could go to college for free, what would you study? Mona replied, science. I like subjects that deal with the planet, water, marine animals, things like environmental science. I'm very intelligent. I went to an academy. I was supposed to go to Cass Tech. I know you've heard of that before. It's for smart children. I asked her, if you had $1 million, what would you do? Mona didn't hesitate. I would bring my family together, get a house, and not struggle.
How did we meet? How does anyone meet? Chance? Fate? Destiny? Divine providence? Where did we meet? Broadly speaking, Earth, North America, United States, Louisiana, New Orleans, the French Quarter. It was on the stairs. The stairs are the spot for street kids to hang out, meet up, do whatever. It's a public access to the Mississippi River for tourists or whoever, I guess. Tourists often see the stairs inhabited with gutter punks and all their gutteriness and choose an alternate access. Old, torn, heavily modified, blood, mud, food-encrusted clothes, festooned with safety pins, spikes, the metal tops of lighters, patches, random zippers, parts of stuffed animals, bits of leather, shoelaces, unemployed buttons, pins for punk bands, pins with smiley faces, maybe a pin for an insurance company. Really, whatever pin of the one-inch variety. Leather jackets seem obvious, but often were the sign of a suburban poser. New, clean, unaltered leather? Probably a poser. He really didn't want to be a poser at the stairs. A loosely organized pack of angry, belligerent, hungry, drunk kids is not a group you want to be on the wrong side of. Bonus biscuit. I don't have first-hand knowledge of this, but the hard rule spoken with heart attack sincerity and hushed, furtive voices is, don't mess with the clowns. Not the name of a gang or a euphemism, but the busker clowns. The word was they were a very dangerous lot to mess with, second only to the cops. Was it bullshit? Who knows? I didn't test it. The few of them I saw were cool as shit. There was kind of a lot you might be concerned about in the Big Easy if you don't act right or come correct. If you don't know what it means, it's pretty standard. Be polite, unless you shouldn't. Respectful, unless disrespected. Generally, mind your own business. Dreamer and I were chilling on the stairs, him on his ever-present, ongoing quest to get his hands on magic mushrooms, as he called them. We all called them that back then. Me on my ever-present, ongoing quest to win life by out-partying it. It still cracks me up, Dreamer's dream. Dreamer called himself Dreamer. Lots of street people choose or are given handles. I knew his real name, but always called him Dreamer or some derivative thereof. I can't remember his given name. Old boy was from the Pacific Northwest, Washington or Oregon. It was generally understood in the 90s, correctly or incorrectly, that psilocybin mushrooms, the magic fellows, grew in abundance throughout the Pacific Northwest. I'd heard stories of shrooms growing in the cracks of sidewalks after a rain. No shit. People swore to it. Dreamer, clueless to that, hitchhiked to New Orleans to find them. No shit. He was a super sweet, loyal kid. We were both kids at 19. Who killed at percussion. I wanted to call him Drummer, but he wouldn't go for it. Not the hottest pot on the stove, but a good road dog. Well, not really, but I enjoyed his company. We're chilling, and this absolutely stunning blonde girl about my age in an old, dirty, shiny green, crushed velvet dress appears beside me. Puts her hand in mine, then just sits there, looking around like it's the most natural thing in the world. I rolled with it, held her hand. What could go wrong? Lots. Lots could go wrong. Lots of shitty, scammy stuff. I had no inkling that might be the case, however. For one, I'd seen her around and definitely noticed she was hot. Dirty street urchin hot. Yellow blonde hair, dirty tangled, left to hang loose past her shoulders. Adorable, almost cherubic, round face, filled in, maybe a little plump. Bright, twinkly, crystal blue eyes that smiled even when she was sad. Filled in describes her figure as well. Buxom and firm, sweeping curves. Smooth, pale neck, heavy breasts framed by her shapely, soft arms. Delicate porcelain hands flicking her womanly hips and big old round booty. Thighs and tiny slippered feet. With that initial meeting, we became inseparable. Dreamer would bop off on his own side missions and we'd meet back up. The girl and I didn't leave each other's side, except for water closet breaks, sometimes, and the rare, one, shower at the shelter. We would hold hands, but mostly she wanted to hold on to my shirt in a way like she was my girl. No conversation, no heart to heart, just we were together now. It seemed her main motivations were feeling safe and covering her minimum needs. Basically food. She liked the affection I showed her, but I think that was just a bonus to her. I made her feel safe, and that made me love her. Love her as only a 19-year-old dumbass loves a girl he doesn't know. She didn't enjoy drinking and was a chill drunk with the occasional outpouring of crap she had been caused to hold in over the years. Mostly, we were just fun, goofy, drunk teens. We had a blast. We both thought Dreamer was hysterical. She was on Team Drummer, but Dreamer wouldn't budge from his chosen moniker. He was constantly drumming in some way, his hands or sticks or plasticware, constantly. It wasn't annoying either. He was good. It was entertaining. There were halcyon days and nights. We were living the dream. The girl. She did tell me her name, but I've forgotten, much to my chagrin and shame. It feels cheap to give her a bullshit name. Thinking of her as the girl in the shiny green dress canonizes her for me. I don't feel heartbreak or heartache for her. Maybe we finished our story. It may be different for her. I know in my bones she remembers me. The girl did tell me a bit of her story. I never asked or pressed for more. My making her feel safe was deeply profound for her. In her young life, feeling safe was the exception, not the rule. A far too common story of abuse by loved ones and no protection. So she split from there. Just left with only her fancy green dress and a beat-up pair of flats. The green dress was a totem for her. I'm not sure why, but it was special to her. She didn't even own underwear and didn't want to. Oh, and a busted-out pair of flats. Three things. You may be thinking, oh, how sweet, two young lovers in love. But we weren't lovers. We kissed casually with love as longtime partners might, as naturally as can be. We cuddled as if we might melt into one being never to be separated. We never got naked together. We never made out, just smooch and cuddle. If we left it at that, it might be easy to dismiss our affair. But the intimacy we felt was of a type I've never felt since and likely never will. Now, in what is called middle age, I have stories of love and marriage, passionate, crazy marathons of debauchery, very close, intimate friends, a loving family. None will ever feel the same as what the girl and I had. It was profoundly special and unique to that time and place for us. We were our actual first loves, not unrequited crushing on each other. It was our first taste of real love. Would it be fair of you to think, all right, bullshit. 19-year-old hormone-fueled drunk dude was satisfied and happy with this? That's fair. It's true that at first I was trying clumsily and obtusely to make minor moves. When she told me her story, the way she told me her story, and I realized that I was the only person in the world who knew her story who wasn't a predator, a switch flipped. She became a fragile, unique flower blossom. She was a blossom the universe handpicked for me to protect. I can say without bluster or reservation, I felt I had been knighted to protect and nurture this girl. Then I ditched her. I know I said we had finished her story, and I guess we did, but looking back all these years later, I can say my dumbass teen self shit the bed. I threw it away on a panicked impulse, a selfish, cowardly whim. I ran away home. More to come.